service. And I always forgot or lost the old devices or the old computers, and then had to begin again. "All the info's in the phone," I said. I unlocked it for her and gave it to her. I watched as she brought the devices up to date. I watched as she shared my information with David and David's information with me, and I was ashamed to admit that I was glad I had these ephemeral numbers. I chewed a record of all this to my attorney, and he'd keep it through thick and thin, even when I'd forgotten how to access it online myself. "Now please," Jesse said finally, "spread the word. Express my concerns to Marius, to Armand, to Louis, to Benji, to everyone. It will drive Benji out of his gourd to have secret intelligence about the twins perhaps immolating themselves," David said. "That I will not do, but I will indeed try to find Marius." "Surely there are old ones in Paris," I said, "old enough to have spied on us here tonight." I wasn't speaking of the riffraff. Yet I had the feeling Jesse didn't care. Let the riffraff hear it, for all Jesse cared. Let the old ones hear it. Jesse was frayed from conflict and anxiety, and even confiding in us had not eased her pain. "Were you ever happy in the blood?" I asked suddenly. She was startled. "What do you mean?"
"In the beginning, during those first years, were you happy?"
"Yes," she said. "And I know that I will be happy again. Life is a gift. Immortality is a precious gift. It shouldn't be called the dark gift. That's not fair."
"I want to see Maharit in person," said David. "I want to go with you home."
Jessie shook her head. "She won't allow it, David. She knew what I meant to say when I found you. She allowed this. But she will not receive anyone now at home."
"Do you still trust in her?" asked David.
"In Maharit?" Jessie asked. "Always. Yes, in Maharit." That was significant. She didn't trust the other two. She was backing away from us towards the double doors to the hallway. "I've given you what I have to give for now," she said.
"And what if I want to find that vampire in Geneva?" I asked.
"That would be your decision. He's in love with you. I can't imagine him hurting you. Does anyone ever try to hurt you?"
"Are you joking?" I asked bitterly. Then I shrugged again. "No, I don't guess anyone ever does anymore."
"You're the one they look to," she said.
"So Benji says," I muttered under my breath. "Well, there's no reason for them to look to me. I may have started it, but I sure as hell can't finish it."
She didn't answer. David sprang up suddenly and went to her and took her in his arms. They held each other silently for a moment, and then he went with her to the doors. I knew she was as good at the cloud gift as I was, what with all that ancient blood. She'd leave the hotel by the roof so fast, she might as well have been invisible. David closed the doors behind her.
"I want to go walking," I said. My voice was thick, and suddenly I realized I was weeping. "I want to see that old district where the markets used to be, and the old church. Haven't been there since. Will you come with me?"
I had half a mind to flee now, just go. But I didn't. He nodded. He knew what I wanted. I wanted to see the area of Paris where once Les Innocents, the ancient cemetery, had existed, beneath which, in torch-lit catacombs, Armand and his Children of Satan coven had held court. It was there that, orphaned by my Maker, I'd discovered with shock the others of our kind. He embraced me and kissed me. This was David whom I knew intimately in this body. This was David's powerful heart against me. His skin was silken and fragrant with some subtle male perfume, and his fingers were thrilling me vaguely as he took my hand. Blood of my blood. "Why do people want me to do something about all this?" I asked. "I don't know what to do."
"You're a star in our world," he said. "You made yourself that. And before you say anything rash or angry, remember, that's what you wanted to be."
We spent hours together. We moved over the rooftops far too fast for the fledglings below to track us. We drifted through the streets of Les Halles, and through the darkened interior of the great old church of Saint Eustache, with its paintings by Rubens. We sought out the little Fontaine des Innocents in the Rue Saint-Denis, a tiny relic of the olden times which had once stood beside the wall of the vanished cemetery. This made my heart both glad and anguished, and I let the memories come back to me of my battles with Armand and his followers, who believed so fervently we were anointed servants of the devil. Such superstition! Such rot! Eventually, some of the paparazzi vampires found us. They were persistent, but they kept their distance. We didn't have much time. Pain. Pain. And more pain. No trace remained of the old Théâtre des Vampires, or where it had once stood. Of course I'd known that, but had to visit the old geography anyway, confirm that the old filthy world of my time had been paved over. Armand's magnificent 19th-century house, which he'd built in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, was shut up and maintained by unwitting mortals, full of murals, carpets, and antique furniture covered in white sheets. He'd refurbished that house for Louis right before the dawn of the 20th century, but I don't think Louis had ever been at home in it. In Interview with the Vampire, he did not so much as even mention it. The fin de siècle, with its glorious painters, actors, and composers, had meant nothing to Louis for all his pretensions to sensitivity. Ah, but I couldn't blame Louis for shunning Paris. He'd lost his beloved Claudia, our beloved Claudia in Paris. How could he be expected ever to forget that? And he'd known Armand was a jungle wildcat among revenants, hadn't he? Still, Paris. I'd suffered here too, had I not? But not at the hands of Paris, no. Paris had always fulfilled my dreams and expectations. Paris, my eternal city, my home. Ah, but Notre Dame. The great, vast cathedral of Notre Dame was, as always, Notre Dame, and there we spent hours together, safe in the cold shadows in that great forest grove of arches and columns, where I'd come more than 200 years ago to weep over my transformation, and was in some way weeping over it even now. David and I walked the narrow, quiet streets of Ile Saint-Louis, talking together. The fledgling paparazzi were within blocks of us, but dared not come closer. The grand townhouse in which I'd made my mother, Gabrielle, into a child of darkness was still there. Gradually, we fell to talking again, naturally. I asked David how he had come to know Farid. "I sought out Farid," David said. "I'd heard plenty of whispers of this mad vampire scientist and his ancient guardian angel, and their evil experiments, you know, the gossip of the misbegotten. So I went to the West Coast and looked for him till I found him." David described the new compound where Seth and Farid were now, safe and secure in the wastes of the California desert, beyond the city of Palm Springs. Out there, they had built the perfect facilities for themselves, isolated and protected by two sets of high walls and mechanical gates, with tunnels for emergency evacuation and a heliport. They ran a small clinic for mortal incurables, but their real work took place in secure laboratories in sprawling three-story buildings. They were close enough to other medical facilities for their activities to attract little or no attention, and far enough away from everything else to have the isolation and land they had needed but could not have in Los Angeles. They'd welcomed David immediately. Indeed, they'd been so hospitable that one could not imagine them being anything but that to everyone. David had pressed Farid on a very special issue. How was his mind and his soul anchored now in this body in which he had not been born, his own body being in a grave in England? Farid had done every conceivable test that he could on David. He could find no evidence that any intelligence existed inside him that was not generated by and expressed through his own brain. As far as he could see, David was David in this body, and his connection with it was utterly secure. "Before you came into the blood," Farid had told David, Very possibly you could have exited this body. You could have been some sort of discarnate entity, a ghost, in other words, capable of possessing other susceptible bodies. I don't know. I can't know. Because you are in the blood now, and very likely this blood has more securely than ever bound you to your physicality. Speculation. But David had been comforted. He too felt that Farid and Seth would never seek to use their scientific knowledge against humans. "But what about their underlings?" I asked. "They were already bringing doctors and scientists into the blood when I met them." "Be assured, they pick and choose carefully. The vampire researchers I encountered were like idiot savants of their profession, obsessed, focused, completely devoid of any grand schemes, in love with studying our blood under microscopes." "And that is his central project, is it not?" I asked. "To study our blood? The blood, so to speak?" "It's a frustrating proposition, from what I understand, as whatever the sacred core is physically, we cannot see it. If it's made of cells, the cells are infinitely smaller than the cells that we can see. So Farid's working with properties." David rambled on, but it was science poetry again, and I couldn't absorb it. "Do you think they're still there, in that same location?"
"I know they are," David said. "They tried a number of others first that did not work out."
"Perhaps that was when I was searching for them."
"They're there. You can easily find them. In fact, they would be overjoyed if you would come to see them."
The night was rolling to an end. The paparazzi had retreated to their coffins and lairs. I told David he could keep my suite at the hotel as long as he liked, and I had to head home soon. But not quite yet. We'd been walking in the Grand Couvert of the Tuileries, in tree-shrouded darkness. "I'm thirsting," I said aloud. At once he suggested where we might hunt. "No, for your blood," I said, pushing him backwards against the slender but firm trunk of a tree.
"You damnable brat," he seethed. "Oh, yes, despise me, please," I said as I closed in.
I pushed his face to one side, kissing his throat first, and then sinking my fangs very slowly, my tongue ready for those first radiant drops. I think I heard him say the single word, "caution." But once the blood struck the roof of my mouth, I wasn't hearing clearly or seeing clearly, and didn't care. I had to force myself to pull back. I held a mouthful of blood as long as I could until it seemed to be absorbed without my swallowing, and I let those last ripples of warmth pass through my fingers and toes. "And you?" I asked. He was slumped there against the tree, obviously dizzy. I went to take him in my arms.
"Get away from me," he growled,
and started off walking, fast away from me.
"Stick your filthy doigt de seigneur right through your greedy heart."
But I caught up with him, and he didn't resist when I put my arm around him, and we walked on together like that.
"Now, that's an idea," I said, kissing him quickly, though he stared forward and continued to ignore me. "If I was king of the vampires, I'd make it the right of every maker to drink from his fledgling any time he chose. Maybe it would be good to be king. Didn't Mel Brooks say, 'It's good to be the king'?" And then, in his droll, cultured British voice, he said with uncharacteristic brashness, "Kindly shut up." Seems I heard other voices in Paris. Seems I sensed things. Seems I might have paid a little more attention and not so cavalierly lumped all intrusions on my mind with the paparazzi vampires. There was a point right after that when we were walking near the old catacombs, where the bones of the old 18th-century cemetery, Les Innocents, had been gathered, that I heard something, something distinct and plaintive, the voice of an old immortal singing, laughing, murmuring. "Ah, young one, you are riding the devil's road in such glory." I knew that voice, knew that timbre, that slow, lilting tone.
and with your venerable battle-axe beneath your splendid raiment. But I closed my ears. I wanted to be with David just then, and only David. We made our way back to the Tuileries. I didn't want complications or new discoveries. I wasn't ready yet to be open as I'd once been to the mysteries surrounding me. And so I ignored that strange rumbling song. I never even knew if David could hear it. And finally I told David I had to go back now into exile. I had no choice. I assured him that I was not in danger of trying to end it, just not ready at all to come together with others or to think about the horrific possibilities that had alarmed Jesse. He was all mollified by then and didn't want me to vanish on him. "Yes, I have a safe refuge," I insisted. "A good refuge. Be assured. Yes, I will use the iPhone magic to communicate." I had turned to leave him when he took hold of me. His teeth went into the artery before I could think what was happening, and his arms went tight around my chest. His pull was so strong that I swooned. Seems I turned and put my arms around him, catching his head in my left hand, and struggled with him. But the visions had opened up, and I didn't know one realm from the other for a moment. And the manicured paths and trees of the Tuileries had become the savage garden of all the world. I'd fallen into a divine surrender, with his heart pounding against my heart. There was no restraint in him, no caution such as I'd shown in feeding on him. I came to myself on the ground, my back to the trunk of a young chestnut tree, and he was gone. And the mild, balmy night had turned to a grey winter dawn. Home I went, to my undisclosed location, only minutes away on the currents of the wind, to ponder what I'd learned from my friends, because I couldn't do anything else. The next night, on rising, I caught the scent of David on my jacket, even on my hands. I fought off the desire for him, and forced myself to relearn how to use my powerful computer, and to obtain yet another email address through another service, and then I sent a long missive to Maharet. I asked if I might visit her, wherever she was, and if not, would she communicate with me in this way? I let her know that I was aware of how things were changing for us, and how Benji's pleas for leadership on the part of the older ones echoed the feelings of many, but I myself did not know how to respond. I asked for her thoughts. Her communication was brief. I must not try to find her. Under no circumstances approach her. Of course I asked why. She never replied. And 6 months later, her numbers were disconnected, email no longer valid. And in time I forgot again how to use the computer. The little iPhone rang a number of times. It was David. We'd talk. It would be brief. And then I'd forget to recharge the little thing. He did tell me he'd found Marius in Brazil, and he was heading there to talk with him. He told me that Daniel Malloy, Marius's companion, was in very good spirits, and that Daniel was taking him to Marius. But I didn't hear from him again. Truth was, I lost the little iPhone, and went back to calling my attorneys in Paris and New York now, as I had always done, with an old-fashioned landline phone. A year passed. I was lodged now in my father's chateau in the mountains of the Auvergne, in my special hiding place in plain sight, so to speak, and where no one thought to look for me, the renovations on it now almost complete. And the voice came again. "Have you no desire to punish those fledglings in the capital?" he asked. "Those vermin who chased you out of Paris last time you were roaming there?" "Ah, voice! Where have you been?" I asked. I was at my desk drawing up plans for the new rooms that would soon be added to this old chateau. "Have you been well?" "Why did you not destroy them?" he asked. "Why do you not go there and destroy them now?" "Not my style, voice," I said. "Too often in the past I've taken life, both human and preternatural. I have no interest now in doing such things." "They drove you out of your city." "No, they didn't," I said. Goodbye, voice. I have things to do. I was afraid you would take this attitude, he said. I should have known. Where are you, voice? Who are you? Why do we always meet like this in ordeal encounters at odd moments? Aren't we ever going to meet again, face to face? Ah, what a blunder. No sooner were the words out of my mouth than I looked to the great 18th-century mirror over the mantelpiece, and there he was, of course, in the guise of my reflection, down to the old bag-sleeve shirt I wore, and my loose hair, only he wasn't reflecting me otherwise, but rather peered at me as if he were trapped in a glass box. Lestat's face twisted with anger, almost petulant, childish. I studied the image in the mirror for a moment, and then I used my considerable powers to force it to disappear. That felt extremely good, subtle and good. I could do that now, I knew, and though I could hear a low rumbling in my head, I was able to sink it down, down below the lovely music, the music of Cybele playing the piano that came from my computer. Cybele broadcasting from New York. The simple fact was, I wasn't interested in him any more. I didn't even bother to thank him for advising me to come home here, home to these stone rooms in which I'd been born, home to the quiet of this mountain top. Why didn't I do that? It was he who'd put the idea in my head, he who'd guided me back to the old fields and forests, to this sublime rural quiet, this breathtaking and familiar solitude where I felt so safe, so content. I didn't care enough to thank him. Oh, it would have been nice to identify him before banishing him forever, but we don't always get what we want.
Part 2. The Open Highway Through the Savage Garden. 5. The Story of Rose. The first time Rose saw Uncle Lestan, he carried her up into the stars. That's how she remembered it, and nothing ever weakened the conviction that he'd scooped her up from the terrace by the sea wall and carried her straight through the clouds and towards the heavens. Rose remembered always the chill of the wind and those stars above her, millions of stars fixed in the black sky like myriad burning lights. She remembered Uncle Lestan's arms around her, and the way he whispered to her not to be afraid, the way he brought his coat close to protect her. They were on another island when Rose learned her mother had died in the earthquake. Everyone had died. The entire little island had gone down into the sea, but this island would not, Uncle Lestan said. She was safe with him here. He'd find her people in America. He gave her a beautiful doll with long blonde hair and a pink dress and bare feet. It was made of vinyl and would never break. This was in a beautiful house with rounded windows and big balconies over the sea, and two very gentle ladies took care of Rose, though she couldn't understand a word they said. Uncle Lestan explained they were Greek ladies, but he wanted Rose to remember. What was her last name? What was her mother's name? Rose said her mother's name was Morning Star Fisher. She had no father. Her grandparents didn't like her because they didn't know who her father was, and they wouldn't give money any more to Morning Star. Rose remembered seeing her grandmother and grandfather in Athens, Texas.
"We don't know who her father is," the old man had said.
Rose's mum had given up and carried Rose out of the little brick house and across a big field, and they'd hitched a ride to the airport in Dallas and flown away with Mum's new friend, J-Rock, who had money from his band to live in Greece for at least a year.
"They don't want me," Rose said. "Can I stay with you?"
Uncle Lestan was so kind to Rose. He had darkly tanned skin and the most beautiful blue eyes Rose had ever seen. When he smiled, Rose loved him. Uncle Lestan said,
"I'll be with you, Rose, as long as you need me."
She woke in the night, crying for her mother. He held her in his arms. He felt so strong, so powerful. They stood on the edge of the patio, looking up at the cloudy sky. He told her that she was sweet and good and beautiful, and he wanted her to be happy.
"When you grow up, Rose, you can be anything you want," Uncle Lestan said. "Remember that. This is a magnificent world, and we are blessed with the gift of life in it."
He sang to her in a low voice. He told her this was Serenade, from an operetta called The Student Prince. The song made her cry. It was so beautiful.
"Remember always," he said, "that nothing is as precious to us as the magnificent gift of life. Let the moon and the stars always remind you of this, that though we are tiny creatures in this universe, we are filled with life."
Rose felt she knew what magnificent was, as she looked out over the shining waters below, and then up once more at those stars twinkling beyond the mist. Uncle Lestan's left fingers touched the flowering vines that covered the railing, and he tore off a small handful of petals for Rose, and said that she was as soft and precious as these petals, a precious living thing. When Rose thought back on it, she remembered seeing him several times before the night the island sank into the sea. He'd been roaming around on that island. He was a tall man with beautiful blonde hair, just the most beautiful hair. It was long and full, and he wore it back, tied at the back of his neck with a little black string. He always wore a velvet coat, just like Rose's best velvet dress, which had been in her suitcase. He had walked around the island looking at things. He wore shiny black boots, very smooth, without buckles. Not cowboy boots. And whenever he happened to pass Rose, he smiled at her, and he winked. Rose hated Athens, Texas. But he took her there, though she could not clearly remember the trip. Just waking up in the Dallas airport with a nice lady to take care of her, and a porter collecting their bags. Uncle Lestan showed up the next night. The old woman and the old man didn't want her. They sat in a lawyer's office on the town square at night, and the old man said that they didn't have to make this appointment after dark, that he didn't like to drive at night when he didn't have to, that this was disruptive, and he and his wife could have explained all this on the telephone. The old woman just shook her head as the old man explained, "We didn't have anything to do with Morningstar, you see. What with the musicians and the drugs? We don't know this child." The lawyers talked on and on. But Uncle Lestan became angry.
"Look, I want to adopt her," he said. "Make it happen."
That was the first time Rose had ever heard someone say, "Make it happen." And it was the first and last time she ever saw Uncle Lestan angry. He'd dropped his angry voice to a whisper, but he'd made everybody in the room jump, especially Rose, and when he saw this, he took Rose in his arms and carried her outside the building for a walk around the little town.
"I'll always take care of you, Rose," he said. "You're my responsibility now, and I'm glad of it. I want you to have everything, Rose, and I'll see to it that you do. I don't know what's wrong with those people, that they don't love you. I love you."
Rose went to live in Florida, with Aunt Julie and Aunt Marge, in a beautiful house blocks from the sea. The sand on the beach was as white and fine as sugar. Rose had her own room with flowered wallpaper and a canopy bed, and dolls and books that Uncle Lestan sent to her. Uncle Lestan wrote her letters in the most beautiful handwriting and black ink on pink paper. Aunt Marge drove Rose to a private school called the Country Lane Academy. The school was a wonderland of games to play and projects to do, and computers on which to write words and bright-faced, eager teachers. There were only 50 students in the whole school, and Rose was reading Dr. Seuss in no time. On Tuesdays, the whole school spoke Spanish and only Spanish, and they went on trips to museums and zoos, and Rose loved all this. At home, Aunt Marge and Aunt Julie helped Rose with her homework, and they baked cakes and cookies, and when the weather was cool, they cooked barbecue outdoors and drank lemonade mixed with iced tea with lots of sugar. Rose loved swimming in the Gulf. For her 6th birthday, Aunt Marge and Aunt Julie gave a party and invited the whole school to come, even the older kids, and it was the best picnic ever. By the time Rose was 10, she understood that Aunt Julie and Aunt Marge were paid to take care of her. Uncle Lestan was her legal guardian. But she never doubted that her aunts loved her, and she loved them. They were retired schoolteachers, Aunt Julie and Aunt Marge, and they talked all the time about how good Uncle Lestan was to all of them, and they were all happy together when Uncle Lestan came to visit. It was always late in the evening when he arrived, and he brought presents for everyone, books, clothes, laptop computers, and wonderful gadgets. Sometimes he came in a big black car. Other times he just appeared, and Rose laughed to herself when she saw how mussed his hair was, because she knew he'd been flying. Flying like that first time, when the little island had sunk into the sea, and he had carried her up into the heavens. But Rose never told anyone about that, and as she got older she came to think that it just couldn't have happened. She'd gone from the Country Lane Academy to the Wilmot School, some 50 miles farther away, and there she was really getting into the most fascinating subjects. She loved literature and history best of all, and after that, music and art appreciation and French. But she did all right in science and math because she felt she had to. Everybody would be so disappointed if she did not do well, but what she really wanted was to read all the time, and her happiest times at school were in the library. When Uncle Lestan called, she told him all about it, and they talked of books he loved and that she loved, and he reminded her, "Rose, when you grow up, remember, you can be anything you want. You can be a writer, a poet, a singer, a dancer, a teacher, anything." When Rose turned 13, she and her aunts went on a tour of Europe. Uncle Lestan wasn't with them, but he had paid for everything. This was the greatest time of Rose's life. They spent 3 whole months travelling together and went to all the great cities of the world in what Uncle Lestan called the Grand Tour. And they visited Russia, too, spending 5 days in St. Petersburg and 5 days in Moscow. For Rose, it was all about the most beautiful old buildings, palaces, castles, cathedrals, ancient towns, and the museums filled with the paintings she'd read about and saw now with her own eyes. Above all else, Rose loved Rome, Florence and Venice. But everywhere she turned, Rose was enchanted by new discoveries. Uncle Lestan surprised her when they were in Amsterdam. He had a secret key to the Rijksmuseum because he was a patron, and he took Rose through it in the evening hours so they could be alone and linger as long as they wanted before the great Rembrandt paintings. He arranged after-hours showings like that for them in many cities. But Amsterdam had a place in Rose's heart, because there Uncle Lestan had been with her. When Rose was 15, she got into trouble. She took the family car without permission. She didn't have a driver's license yet, and it was her plan to get the car back before either Aunt Julie or Aunt Marge woke up. She'd only wanted to drive a few hours with her new friends Betty and Charlotte, and none of them thought anything bad would happen. But they got into a fender bender on the highway, and Rose ended up in juvenile court. Aunt Julie and Aunt Marge sent word to Uncle Lestan that he was travelling, and no one could find him. Rose was glad. She was so shamed, so miserable, so afraid that he would be disappointed in her. The judge who heard the case shocked everyone. He let off Betty and Charlotte, because they had not stolen the car. But he sentenced Rose to Amazing Grace Home for Girls for the period of 1 year, due to her criminal behaviour. He gave a dire warning to Rose that if she did not behave well at Amazing Grace, he would extend her stay till she was 18, and possibly even longer. He said Rose had been in danger of becoming an addict with her antisocial behaviour, and possibly even a street person. Aunt Marge and Aunt Julie were frantic, begging the judge not to do this. Again and again they argued, as did the lawyers, that they were not pressing charges against Rose for stealing the car, that this had been a prank and nothing more, that the child's uncle must be contacted. It did no good. Rose was handcuffed and taken as a prisoner to the Amazing Grace Home for Girls, somewhere in southern Florida. All the way there she sat quiet, numb with fear, while the men and women in the car talked of a good Christian environment, where Rose would learn the Bible, and learn how to be a good girl, and come back to her aunts, an obedient Christian child. The home exceeded Rose's worst fears. She was met by the minister, Dr. Hayes, and his wife, Mrs. Hayes, both of whom were well-dressed and smiling and gracious. But as soon as the police were gone and they were alone with Rose, they told her that she must admit all the bad things she'd done, or Amazing Grace wasn't going to be able to help her.
"You know the things you've done with boys," Mrs. Hayes said. "You know what drugs you've used, the kind of music you've been listening to."
Rose was frantic. She'd never done anything bad with boys, and her favourite music was classical. Sure, she did listen to rock music, but... Mrs. Hayes shook her head. "Denying who and what she had done was bad," said Mrs. Hayes. She did not want to see Rose again until Rose had had a change of attitude. Rose was given ugly, shapeless clothes to wear and escorted everywhere around the grim, sterile buildings by two older students who stood guard over her even when she had to use the bathroom. They would not give her a minute of privacy. They watched her when she performed the most delicate of bodily functions. The food was unbearable, and lessons were reading and copying Bible verses. Rose was slapped for making eye contact with other girls, or with teachers, or for trying to talk, or for asking questions, and made to scrub the dining room on her hands and knees for failing to show a good attitude. When Rose demanded to call home to talk to her aunts about where she was taken to a time-out room, a small closet with one high window, and there she was beaten with a leather belt by an older woman who told her that she had better show a change of attitude now, and that if she didn't, she'd never be allowed a phone call to her family.
"Do you want to be a bad girl?" asked the woman sorrowfully. "Don't you understand what your parents are trying to do for you here? Your parents don't want you now. You rebelled. You disappointed them."
Rose lay on the floor of that room for 2 days, crying. There was a bucket and a pallet there, and nothing else. The floor smelled of chemical cleaners and urine. Twice people came in with food for her. An older girl crouched down and whispered, "Just go along with it. You can't win against these people. And please, eat. If you don't eat, they'll keep giving you the same plate over and over until you do eat the food, even if it's rotting." Rose was furious. Where were Aunt Julie and Aunt Marge? Where was Uncle Lestan? What if Uncle Lestan knew what had happened and he was angry and disgusted with her? She couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe he'd turn his back on her like that, not without talking to her. But she was consumed with shame for what she'd done, and she was ashamed of herself now in the shapeless clothes, her body unwashed, her hair unwashed, her skin itching and feverish. She felt feverish all over, and her system had locked up. In the bathroom, before the watchful eyes of her guardians, she could not move her bowels. Her body ached, and her head ached. In fact, she was feeling the worst pain she'd ever known in her stomach and in her head. Rose was surely running a temperature by the time she was taken to the first group session. Without a shower or bath, she felt filthy. They put a paper sign on her that said, "I am a slut," and told her to admit that she had used drugs, that she'd listened to satanic music, that she'd slept with boys. Over and over Rose said that she had not slept with anyone, that she had not done drugs. Again and again other girls stood before her screaming at her, "Admit! Admit! Say it! I am a slut! Say it! I am an addict!" Rose refused. She started screaming. She'd never done drugs in her life. No one at the Wilmont school did drugs. She'd never been with a boy except to kiss at a dance. She found herself down on the floor, with other girls sitting on her legs and her arms. She couldn't stop screaming until her mouth filled with vomit. She almost choked on it. With all her soul, she struggled, screaming louder and louder, spitting vomit everywhere. When Rose awoke, she was alone in a room, and she knew she was more than just a little sick. She was hot all over, and the pain in her stomach was unbearable. Her head was on fire. Over and over, when she heard another person passing, she asked for water. The answer came back, "Faker." How long did she lie there? It seemed like days, but soon she was half dreaming. Over and over she prayed to Uncle Lestan, "Come get me, please. Come get me. I didn't mean to do it. Please. Please forgive me." She couldn't imagine that he would want her to suffer like this. Surely Aunt Julie and Aunt Marge had told him what was happening. Aunt Marge had been hysterical by the time they took Rose away. At some point, Rose realized something. She was dying. All she could think of now was water. And every time she drifted off, it was a dream that someone was giving her water. And then she'd wake and there was no water, and there was no one there, no one passing, no one saying Faker, and no one saying Admit. A strange calm came over Rose. So this is how her life would end, she thought, and maybe Uncle Lestan just didn't know or didn't understand how bad it was. What would it matter? She slept and she dreamed. But she kept shivering and waking with a jolt. Her lips were cracked, and there was so much pain in her stomach and chest and her head that she could feel nothing else. Sliding in and out, dreaming of cold, clear water in glasses from which she could drink, she heard sirens go off. They were loud, screeching sirens far away, but coming closer, and then alarms within this place itself went off, blasting with horrific volume. Rose could smell smoke, she could see the flicker of flames, she heard the girls screaming. Right before her, the wall broke apart, and so did the ceiling. The whole room blew apart, with chunks of plaster and wood flying in all directions. Wind swept through the room. The screams around her grew louder and louder. A man came towards Rose. He looked like Uncle Lestan, but it wasn't Uncle Lestan. It was a dark-haired man, and a beautiful man, with the same bright eyes that Uncle Lestan had, except this man's eyes were green. He scooped Rose up from her pallet, and wrapped her in something warm and close, and then they went upwards. Rose saw flames all around as they rose. The entire compound was burning. The man carried her up and up into the sky, just as it had happened long years ago above the little island. The air was marvellously cold and fresh. "Yes, the stars," she whispered. When she saw the great sweep of diamond-bright stars, she was that little child again in Uncle Lestan's arms. A gentle voice spoke in her ear.
"Sleep, Rose. You're safe now. I'm taking you to your Uncle Lestan."
Rose woke in a hospital room. She was surrounded by people in white coats and masks. A kindly female voice said,
"You're going to be all right, darling. I'm giving you something to make you sleep."
Behind the nurse stood that man, that dark-haired man with the green eyes who'd brought Rose here. He had the same darkly tanned skin as Uncle Lestan had, and his fingers felt like silk as he stroked Rose's cheek now.
"I'm your uncle's friend, Rose," he said. "My name's Louis."
He pronounced it the French way, Louis.
"Believe me, Rose, your uncle will be here soon. He's on his way. He'll take care of you, and I'll be here until he comes."
Next time she opened her eyes, she felt completely different. All the pain and pressure were gone from her stomach and chest. They'd evacuated all the waste from her body. She realized that. And when she thought of how revolting that must have been, fingers prying into her unwashed flesh, removing all that filth, she felt ashamed again and sobbed against the pillow. She felt to blame and miserable. The tall, dark-haired man stroked her hair and told her not to worry any more.
"Your Aunt Julie is on the way. Your uncle is on the way. Go back to sleep, Rose."
Though she was groggy and confused, she could see she was being given fluids and something white, some sort of IV nourishment. The doctor came. She said it would be about a week before Rose could leave, but the danger was past. It had been touch and go there for a while, all right. But Rose would be fine. The infection was under control. Rose was hydrated now. The man named Louis thanked the doctor and the nurse. Rose blinked through her tears. The room was filled with flowers.
"He sent you lilies," said Louis.
He had a soft, deep voice.
"He sent you roses, too. All colors of roses. Your flower, Rose."
When Rose started to apologize for what she'd done, Louis wouldn't hear of it. He told her the people who'd taken her were evil. The judge had gotten kickbacks from the Christian home to send perfectly decent teenagers there for incarceration. The school bilked the parents of the children and the state for exorbitant payments. He said that the judge would soon be in jail. As for the home, it was gone, burned down, shut up, and lawyers would see that it never opened again.
"It was wrong, what they did to you,"
he whispered. In his soft, unhurried voice, he said there would be many lawsuits against the home, and the remains of two bodies had been found buried on the grounds. He wanted Rose to know these people would be punished. Rose was amazed. She wanted to explain about the car, that she had never meant to hurt anybody.
"I know," he said. "It was a little thing. It was nothing. Your uncle is not angry with you now. He would never be angry with you over such a thing. Sleep now."
By the time Uncle Lestan came, Rose was home with Aunt Marge in a Miami Beach apartment. She had lost weight and felt frail, and jumped at the slightest noise, but she was much better. Uncle Lestan took her into his arms, and they went out to walk along the beach together.
"I want you to go to New York," said Uncle Lestan. "New York is the capital of the world, and I want you to go to school there. Aunt Marge is going to take you, and Julie will stay behind. Florida is her home, and she can't adjust to the big city. But Aunt Marge will take care of you, and you're to have other companions now, good, decent security guards who'll keep you both safe. I want you to have the finest education."
He went on, "Remember, Rose,
whatever you've suffered, no matter how bad it's been, you can use that. Use that to be a stronger person."
For hours they talked, not about the horrid Christian home, but about other things. Rose's love of books, her dreams of writing poetry and stories some day, and her enthusiasm about New York, and how she so wanted to go to a great university like Harvard, or Stanford, or who knows where. Those were wonderful hours. They'd stopped at a cafe on South Beach, and Uncle Lestan sat there quietly, leaning on his elbows, beaming at her as she poured out all her thoughts and dreams and questions. The new apartment in New York was on the Upper East Side, about two blocks from the park, in a venerable old building with spacious rooms and high ceilings. Aunt Marge and Rose were both overjoyed to be there. Rose went to a marvellous day school, which had a curriculum far superior to that of the Wilmot School. With the help of several tutors, mostly college students, Rose soon caught up and was deep into her schoolwork, preparing to go to college. Though Rose missed the beautiful beach in Florida, and the lovely, warm, sweet, rural nights, she was ecstatic to be in New York, loved her schoolmates, and was secretly happy that Aunt Marge was with her and not Aunt Julie, as Aunt Marge had always been the adventurous one, the mischievous one, and they had more fun together. Their household soon included a permanent housekeeper and cook, and the security guard drivers who took them everywhere. There were times when Rose wanted to strike out on her own, meet kids on her own, take the subway, be independent. But Uncle Lestan was adamant. Rose's drivers went where Rose went. Embarrassed as Rose was by the big stretch Lincoln limousine that dropped her off at school, she came to depend on this. And these drivers were all past masters of double parking anywhere in Midtown while Rose shopped, and thought nothing of carrying 20 and 30 bundles, and even braving the checkout lines for Rose, or running errands for her. They were young, mostly, cheerful guys, and kind of like guardian angels. Aunt Marge was frank about enjoying all this completely. It was a new way of life, and it had its charms, but the real lure, of course, was New York itself. She and Aunt Marge had subscription tickets to the symphony, the New York City Ballet, the Metropolitan Opera. They attended the latest musicals on Broadway and plenty of off-Broadway plays. They shopped at Bergdorf Goodman and Saks. They roamed the Metropolitan Museum for hours on Saturdays and often spent weekends visiting the galleries in the Village and Soho. This was life. Over the phone, Rose talked endlessly to Uncle Lestan about this or that play she'd seen, or concert, or what was happening with Shakespeare in the Park, and how they wanted to go to Boston this weekend just to see it, and perhaps visit Harvard. The summer before Rose's senior year, she and Aunt Marge met Uncle Lestan in London, for a marvellous week of visiting the most wonderful sights after hours, and with private guides. Then Aunt Marge and Rose went on to Rome, and to Florence, and a whole string of other cities before returning to New York just in time for school to start. It was sometime just before her 18th birthday that Rose turned to the Internet to research the ghastly Amazing Grace Home for Girls, where she'd been imprisoned. She had never told anyone she knew about what actually happened to her there. The news reports confirmed everything Louis had told her long ago. The judge who'd sent Rose there had gone to prison, and two lawyers had gone with him. On Rose's last night there, apparently, a boiler had exploded, setting fire to the entire establishment. Two other explosions had destroyed outbuildings and stables. Rose had never known there were stables. Local firefighters and police had converged on the school to find girls wandering the grounds, dazed and incoherent from the shock of the blast, and many had had visible welts and bruises from being beaten. One or two had shaved heads, and two had been taken to local emergency rooms due to malnutrition and dehydration. Some girls had the words slut and addict written on them with felt-tip pen. Newspaper stories reflected contempt and outrage. They railed against the school as a racket, part of the unregulated, religious, troubled teen industry, in which parents were bilked out of thousands of dollars to pay for reformation of teen girls they feared were in danger of becoming druggies or dropouts or suicides. Everybody connected with the place had been indicted for something, it seemed, but charges eventually were dropped. There was no law requiring regulation of religious schools in Florida, and the owners and faculty of the place dropped out of the record. But it was easy to trace Dr. Hayes and Mrs. Hayes. They had both died within months in a fiery home invasion. One of the other more notorious teachers had drowned off Miami Beach, and yet another had been killed in a car wreck. Rose hated to admit it, but this gave her a great deal of satisfaction. At the same time, something about it bothered Rose. A terrible feeling crept over her. Had someone punished these people for what they'd done, done to Rose and to others? But that was absurd. Who would do such a thing? Who could do such a thing? She put it out of her mind, and it was dreadful, she told herself, to be glad these people were dead. Rose did a little more reading on the troubled teen industry and other scandals besetting these unregulated Christian schools and homes, but then she couldn't endure another moment of thinking of it all. It made her too angry, and when she became angry, she became ashamed, ashamed that she'd ever... There was no end to it. She closed the book on that brief and horrid chapter of her life. The present beckoned. Uncle Lestan wanted Rose to follow her own star when it came to college. He assured her nothing was off-limits. She and Marge flew to California to visit Stanford and the University of California at Berkeley. Stanford, near beautiful Palo Alto, California, was Rose's final choice, and Rose and Marge moved the July before school started. Uncle Lestan met Rose in San Francisco for a brief holiday in August. Rose fell in love with the city, and had half a mind to live there and commute. Uncle Lestan had another suggestion. Why not live near campus, as planned, and have an apartment in San Francisco? It was soon arranged, and Rose and Marge moved into a spacious modern condo walking distance from Davis Symphony Hall and the San Francisco Opera House. Their small house on a tree-lined street in Palo Alto was charming, and though the change of coasts meant a new housekeeper and two new drivers, Rose was soon settled in and loving the California sunshine. After her first week of classes, Rose was in love with her literature professor, a tall, wiry and introspective man who spoke with the affectation of an actor. Gardner Palestine was his name. He'd been a prodigy of sorts, publishing 4 volumes of poetry as well as 2 books on the work of William Carlos Williams before he was 30. At 35, he was brooding, intense, bombastic and utterly seductive. He flirted openly with Rose and told her over coffee after class that she was the most beautiful young woman he'd ever seen. He emailed her poems about her raven hair and inquisitive eyes. He took her to dinner at expensive restaurants and showed her his large old Georgian-style home in old Palo Alto. His mother and father were dead, he said. His brother had died in Afghanistan, and so he haunted the house now. What a waste. But he couldn't bear to give it up, filled as it was with the rag-and-bone shop of my childhood. When Uncle Lestan came to visit, he took Rose walking through the quiet, leafy streets of Palo Alto. He remarked on the magnolia trees and their hard, rustling green leaves, and how he loved them from his time in the South. He was mussed and dusty all over, and Rose realized that she'd often seen Uncle Lestan this way, exquisitely dressed but dusty. It was on the tip of her tongue to tease him about flying about in the stars, but she didn't. His skin was more darkly tanned than usual and looked almost burned, and his beautiful thick hair was almost white. He wore a dark blue blazer and khaki pants, and black shoes shined to look like glass, and he talked in a low, gentle voice, telling her that she must always remember. She could do absolutely anything in this world that she wanted. She could be a writer, a poet, a musician, an architect, a doctor, a lawyer, whatever it was that she wanted. And if she wanted to marry and make a home for her husband and her children, that was fine too. If money can't buy you the freedom to do anything you want, well, what is the good of it? He asked. He sounded almost sad. And money you have, Rose, plenty of it, and time. And if time can't give us freedom to do what we want, what good is time? Rose felt a terrible pain. She was in love with Uncle Lestan. Beside Uncle Lestan, all thoughts of her teacher, Gardner Pelston, simply faded into nothingness. But Rose didn't say a word. On the verge of tears, she only smiled and explained that, yes, she knew this, that he'd told her this long ago when she'd been a little girl, that she could be and do anything she wanted. "The trouble is, I want to do everything," she said. "I want to live and study here, and live and study in Paris, and in Rome, and in New York. I want to do everything." Uncle Lestan smiled and told her how proud of her he was. "You've grown into a beautiful woman, Rose," he said. "I knew you'd be pretty. You were pretty when I first saw you. But you're beautiful now. You're strong and healthy, and, well, you're beautiful. There's no point mincing words about it." And then he turned suddenly into a tyrant, telling her that her driver had to go with her wherever she went, that he even wanted her driver sitting in the back of her college classrooms when there was room, or right outside of them. Rose argued. She wanted freedom, but he wouldn't hear of it. He had become an overzealous and intensely European guardian, it seemed to Rose, but how could Rose really argue? When she thought of all Uncle Lestan had done for her, she fell silent. All right. Her driver would go everywhere with her. He could carry her books. That would be nice, though these days with iPads and Kindles, she didn't have to carry many books. 6 months after that visit, Rose received a letter from Uncle Lestan saying that she would not be hearing from him so often any more, but that he loved her and he needed this time to be alone. Be assured of his love, and be patient. He would eventually come round, and in the meantime she was entirely safe and must ask his attorneys for whatever her heart desired. That had always been the way, really. And how could she ask for more? A year passed without her hearing from Uncle Lestan. But she had been so busy with other things, and then another year. But it was all right. It would have been wicked and ungrateful to complain, especially when his attorney in Paris called regularly every month. 2 weeks into her junior year, Rose was hopelessly in love again with Gardner Pelston. She was in three of his classes, and certain that she could become a great poet some day if she listened to every single word he said. She'd gone to the campus clinic and gotten the information and pills she needed to prevent any accidental pregnancy, and she was just waiting for the time to be perfect for them to be together. Gardner Pelston called her every evening and talked to her for an hour. She had more potential than any other student he'd ever had, he said. I want to teach you all I know, Rose, he said. I've never felt that way about anyone before. I want to give you all that I can. Do you understand what I'm saying, Rose? Whatever I know, whatever I've learned, whatever I have to pass on, I want to give it to you. It sounded as if he was crying on the other end of the line. Rose was overcome. She wanted desperately to talk with Uncle Lestan about Gardner, but that was not to be. She wrote long letters and sent them to the attorney in Paris and received the most touching little gifts in response. Surely they came from the attorney, she thought. But then each arrived with a gift card signed by Uncle Lestan, and these cards were more precious to her than the pearl necklaces or amethyst brooches they accompanied. Surely Uncle Lestan would one day see Gardner's exceptional talent, his passion, his genius for what it was. As she sat dreaming in class, Gardner Pelston became the most sensitive and brilliant being Rose had ever imagined. He was not as beautiful as Uncle Lestan, no, and he looked older, actually. Perhaps because he didn't have Uncle Lestan's health. She couldn't know. But she came to love everything about Gardner, including his hawk-like nose, his high forehead, and the long fingers with which he gestured dramatically as he strode back and forth before the classroom. How disappointed he was, he declared. How crushed, he said bitterly, that not a single student in this room understands a tenth of what I'm saying here. He bowed.